I think there's still a lot of work to do to make people confident that they're making good decisions in this environment.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. This is part two of my discussion with Mike Madrid and Sasha Eisenberg about Sasha's new book, The Lie Detectives, In Search of a Playbook for Winning Elections in the Disinformation Age. In this two-part series, we look at the information ecosystem from the perspective of campaign professionals. And today in part two, we are going to discuss how tactics and strategies for combating misinformation were adapted from campaigns outside the U.S., a candidate in Brazil who turned a lie about him into a branding opportunity, the scary way the Supreme Court in Brazil tried to fight disinformation, how labeling misinformation and disinformation creates a new problem that someone else has to decide what falls into these categories, and the use of AI in campaigns. Enjoy. I want to move to Jory Craig, because she's like the vehicle through which you tell the story of sort of importing the understanding of how political campaigns are run everywhere else in the world, maybe except in the United States. So she started working on the international team at Greenberg Quinlan Rosner. In a section of the book about campaigns, she worked in the Bahamas. She explained that parties paid to manually bump the number of views on a YouTube video to trick the algorithm into sharing it with more people. Okay. You quote her as saying, "Even to think to do that, you have to be thinking about social media not as a broadcast system, but as a marketplace, as a public square where lots of things are going on." So we know that there are strategies to see social media platforms as a way to push content and to push to get donations. But the through line here is like the difference between the people who think that there's a marketplace versus top-down communications approach, the controlling assumptions, as you mentioned earlier. What are the differences now between how is the Democratic Party, I guess, and the people you've observed adjusting to this new way of responding to the people who are wrong on the internet? Are they getting it? Is the culture changing? And who's now in control? Who's the decision maker? Who's the advisor who's telling the principal? No, actually, that impulse that you have, it's good. Yes, you're right to be offended. Someone's lying about you. You're having a correct impulse, but you can't do anything about it. How is the culture changing in campaign land on the Democratic side?
So I think we should think about both like the sort of defensive question and that proactive or the reactive and proactive sides. On the reactive side, I think that you mentioned that sort of harm matrix that Jory drew and what points you to do nothing. I think that the thinking behind that has become far more widespread among people who are thinking hour to hour about how we communicate in campaigns than it was, 7 or 8 years ago when my narrative starts. But I do think that there's still the problem of novelty. And I think the novelty of digital disinformation has sort of crippled people's ability to bring proper proportion to some of these tactical decisions. Like if I told you there's one guy sitting at the end of one bar in one suburb of Cleveland who's saying some crazy stuff about you, or I told you, there are 200,000 people with signs in downtown Philadelphia that are saying the same thing about you, you'd have like a pretty good heuristic of like, okay, the one guy at the end of the bar in Cleveland, like maybe I don't like what he's saying about me, but that's probably not a huge concern of mine. Okay, 200,000 people downtown with signs, maybe this is a problem. But I quote Jory Craig saying like, if it involves the internet, people's brains are broken.
Yeah.
And I do think that there was an inability of people because digital disinformation became this category of like, threat to democracy, geopolitical crisis, that people did not bring the normal, hey, is this just one person at the end of a bar that happens to be on the internet talking about you, logic to it? I think that has gradually, with time, a little of the novelty has worn off. I think that the do-nothing advice is becoming, a little more mainstreamed. Some of the very basic advice, like, if you're going to respond to something on, to fact check it or rebut it, take a screenshot, don't actually quote tweet it or respond to it, because like the algorithms, the amplification algorithms, just treat that as engagement. You don't want to actually amplify the lie. That stuff, I think, has become like, those sort of best, very technical best practices are becoming learned, you know, up and down the sort of, you know, ladder within campaigns. And so, you know, I think we're in a slightly different place than we were when sort of Jory Craig comes into the picture here. But I think there's still a lot of work to do to make people confident that they're making good decisions in this environment.
Okay, I have pages and pages of notes that I want to get to with on domestic stuff, but I'm going to breeze past a bunch of it because I want to get to Brazil. Because you write a whole chapter on Brazil, and Mike happened to be there during the campaign. So you write that it was like a roller coaster because you talk about Guillermo Boulos and how his team, right, countered this harmful narrative that was coming at him pretty masterfully, because he would lean into it, he would make jokes, he would make light of it, right? And it was very good. And then you write about the Supreme Court and painted a pretty ominous picture, I thought, about the court becoming, not just becoming an arbiter of truth, but really just growing enormously in order to counter all of the people who were wrong on the internet, right? Can you lay out the problem that Boulos had, how his team countered it? And then, Mike, maybe you have some insights about what campaigns could learn from that example, as Sasha will describe it.
Yeah, you know, so he left-wing politician, potential sort of heir to Lula da Silva, who's won office in Sao Paulo. I write about his top digital advisor, and this was a way of sort of thinking about what, you know, sort of, I think, smart thinking about counter disinformation tactics outside of the legal context that really has come to dominate how Brazilian politics works on this. So there was this guy had led, he was a workers' rights activist who had led these basically sit-ins on some corporate properties. And this sort of meme started that he invaded properties, which, you know, we can probably dispute whether how true or not that is a choice of verb, but it certainly was, the way it was used was to suggest that you know, he was like leading a conquering army, and it was a big political problem.
He was going to invade your home.
Yes. And so this became, you know, he invaded a Volkswagen, property owned by Volkswagen, but it became Guillermo Boulos is going to invade your home. And so this was a big attack. It was a problem. And so I quote one of his advisors saying, you know, we wanted to hijack this phrase. It was spreading. The internet was already spreading this term hijack in association with him as a hashtag. And like, you know, so there was already, the algorithms were already driving traffic to this word invade in relation to a politician. And so basically they say, well, it has a negative connotation in the way it's being used now, but there's already like a lot of momentum behind it. Why don't we hijack the momentum and change the connotation? And so they build a whole sort of messaging campaign around Boulos is going to invade your heart. He starts using the word invade all the time in a sort of positive, in a jokily positive way. But the idea is saying, like, let's not push against the structure of social media, which has these sort of opaque algorithms that are driving people to certain things. But let's, you know, if the train's already going to that destination, let's load it up with some cargo that we want to move to. And that ends up being sort of the way that they approach this. It's also worth noting, and this is true of like a lot of the international context, and one of the ways that the U.S. is just so different, is there isn't the same amount of money and opportunities for paid broadcast media that there are in the U.S. And so there is a willingness much earlier in the history of online campaigning to, I think, experiment. To get back to your last question, Ron, you know, that like the tension of the sort of command and control vision of political communications, which was really created in an era where most communication was, as we were saying, happening on broadcast TV and through newspapers, people in other countries never had a politics that was driven by paid television advertising in the same way. And so when the internet came along 20, 25 years ago, there was a much greater willingness, I think, to see it as an opportunity to do things other than just fundraising and sort of putting out digital versions of your TV ads. Right. And so
you had to get creative. You had to get organic reach.
You had to get organic reach. And that means entrusting your supporters to do work for you, to carry your message. And that has always been a really dangerous proposition for American political consultants. So, you know, you have a lot of volunteers show up at your office. Great. What do you do with them? Okay, you send them out to do GOTV, where they are reading a very basic 3-sentence script, and you want them basically to read it to the T and move on to the next house, not go out and try to persuade your neighbors on, you know, whatever you think the issue that they're going to care most about, right? Like, and campaigns have the same view of the internet, which was, okay, like, not, they told their supporters, you know, give us money, maybe share this video that we made, but they were not telling their supporters, oh, go mix it up in the comments, go argue with people on bulletin boards for us. Because if you're a presidential campaign or a statewide campaign, you've spent hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars on research, on policy research, on oppo research, on opinion research. You have framed your message within an inch of its life. And like, you'll be damned if like Charlene, your super enthusiastic volunteer in like the Madison exurbs, is going to be empowered to go like talk to her community, you know, whether that's at the farmer's market or on Facebook. Like, no, Charlene, like, we'll tell you what to do. And I think the fact is that the realization that this younger generation, folks like Jory Craig, have come to in the last few years is that, you know, to take Barack Obama's campaigns, which are the sort of gold standard of online mobilization, you can look back at those and say, yes, they were immensely successful. He has, you know, 14 million names on his email list and more small donors at the time than anybody else had, and blah, blah, blah. Or you can look at it and you can say, hey, one reason that lies and conspiracy theories have gotten so much traction over the last few years is that people like Barack Obama built a lot of weak ties online because they had this very transactional relationship with their supporters. And that some of the communities that have been built around QAnon, election denial, vaccine skepticism are actually more deep, more meaningful, closer to a real online community, because they often...
It is a community. You know,
It is a community. And people feel empowered to speak on behalf and share and carry the word. And in other countries like Brazil, that you didn't need a culture shift, because right. there was never another vision of like, we use the internet for small dollar contributions only.
Mike?
I
have like three questions for you.
Yeah,
but just,
I mean, just as a tactic, there's a couple of ways to deal with this, right? One, and I love the idea of leaning into it and surfing the wave that could otherwise knock you over. I will say it's also kind of a high risk play, right? You've got to be damn sure that your team, meaning your online activists, have that sense of community, have that connection with you, and have that pool, because you don't want that to fall flat or the whole thing falls flat, because you're essentially acknowledging what's being said, right? And saying, whatever they're accusing us of is what they're going to accuse us of, but we are going to invade your hearts, and we are going to invade, you know, on your behalf, right? It kind of reminds me of a technique that has been used by celebrity. I think Lizzo wrote a song about it, right? Where you just say the rumors you hear are true. Right? I'm not going to ignore it, but the rumors you hear are true. And then every rumor that comes in, it's the rumors you hear are true, which completely dispels all of it, right? In a humorous way. Well, the rumors you hear are true. Oh, you beat your dog. Yeah, well, the rumors you hear are true. Oh, you're stealing groceries from an old lady. Yeah, the rumors you hear are true, right? And so all it says is, all of this is bullshit, right? Tacitly acknowledging it's bullshit without acknowledging it. And these techniques are going to start developing, but what they all do require is that linkage, that sense of community behind you, that you're in common cause, and that people, just by the nature of who you are and their relationship with you, whatever that is in their own mind, is enough to stick with you against whatever perceived attacks it is that are coming. I remember, Ron, in the 2020 campaign when we were doing the Lincoln Project. Now, granted, we were in the middle of a pandemic and everybody was at home. What we were telling people was,
even more online.
We're all online. What we were telling people was the best thing you can do is amplify our message. It was the first time we clicked as political consultants when we used to say all this clicktivism and online shit, it's not doing anything. 180 degree shift. And what we were saying was be part of this, amplify this, share our messaging, share what we're doing. And that became the catalyst for overwhelming Donald Trump, who had been the focus of all of the media. And he in his own way toppled the existing media structure and became the focus of all of the attention of the mainstream media in 2016. We essentially flipped that model on its head and said, if all of you join us and amplify us, we can compete with this guy. And we did. And so, you know, all of these do require some level of connection to your followers who are essentially going to follow you. I don't want to say mindlessly, but are so convicted that what you're doing, they're willing to stand with you against the attacks, whether they're true or false. And I like both of those. I think the example you give in Brazil obviously worked very effectively. It requires a very strong level of belief that your people are going to be there with you and amplify that message and lean into your messaging. I'd probably be a little bit more comfortable by saying something like the rumors you hear are true, right? And leaving it at that, because it tells people what you're doing and allows them to kind of move on without giving all this online bullshit as more credit than it deserves.
So that's one approach. Sasha, can you talk about the way the Supreme Court in Brazil tried to fight disinformation and what the rest of the world and the U.S. in particular maybe can learn from that example?
Yeah. So the Brazilian Supreme Electoral Tribunal, they have an electoral court that just adjudicates election disputes. And over the course of the last 6 years or so, the court has cobbled together just this astonishing amount of power and authority that it's basically gifted itself through, some completely outdated statutes like regulating propaganda that go back to the era of the dictatorship, a lot of language that exists in Brazilian law that was not written with the internet in mind, and has become basically a judge, jury, executioner of truth and falsity within Brazilian politics. And so the Chief Justice of the Supreme Electoral Court, Alexandre de Moraes, who's Mike, I don't know if you'd spent time in Brazilian politics before this last election cycle. And one of the things that's just remarkable following the campaign from here and then being in Brazilian Sao Paulo for the last like week or so before the first round of voting, as somebody who does not speak Portuguese but can make out enough to know what the headlines of the stories are about, was how often you would pick up a newspaper or turn on the news and the protagonist of the day's election news was not Bolsonaro or Lula or one of the lesser party candidates or one of their parties or another political figure. It was the judge who was sending, Facebook a takedown notice and they had to remove this content within the hour, or fining a candidate or his supporters, X amount of money because they posted something that was false, or having people jailed for promoting and sharing false information. The Supreme Electoral Court also turned into like this sort of amazing content studio. They partnered with all these fact-checking organizations, some tech companies like WhatsApp, to feed fact-checking content into streams so that if you were in like a group chat and somebody posted something, you could sort of within the app solicit, go and get a fact check from an outside media organization. But this government agency that is on paper a court, but really is functionally a regulatory agency and has investigative and prosecutorial power too, is played a significant role in blocking some of the effectiveness and reach of some of the tactics that Bolsonaro and his supporters had used when he was first elected in 2018. Has been involved in the investigation of the attack on the government buildings before Lula's swearing in. And what it is very interesting to talk to people in Brazil about this, especially on the sort of broad anti-Bolsonaro center of Brazilian politics and on the left and center left. And that is, they are so content with the outcomes that having a powerful election regulator has delivered that they are wary of being too critical of the process. But it is not an oversimplification to say that like liberal democracy in Brazil may have been protected by the most illiberal, undemocratic institution you could really imagine. And one of the things that was really interesting to me is how that changed campaigns' tactics around this, in that they developed this phrase judicialization. And it became, okay, somebody's lying about us on the internet. This isn't a comms problem. It's not a rapid response problem. It's not a digital problem. It's a problem for the lawyers. And it was like, who could file something to the court to get a takedown order sent as quickly as possible to a social media company to have a piece of content removed entirely.
Mike, what was your experience like there during the election? Around what time in the campaign were you there? Were you guys there at the same time?
I think we were. I was in Sao Paulo when covered Lula's kickoff at the Volkswagen plant. There's a whole stretch outside of Sao Paulo of just massive, massive manufacturing campuses from some largest automakers in the world. But it's important to understand, and I mean, what Sasha's saying is exactly right. It's this sort of illiberal force that is protecting democracy, right? With this court, the Supreme Court there has a mythical status because it was central to the toppling of the authoritarian regime in the 70s, the military dictator, and so the court became sort of this, like, they were the protectors of democracy and anti-authoritarianism. And then there's been this creep of everything that they get their hands into, which is their kind of quasi-legislative, regulatory, judicial, executive. They kind of just have this mythical status. And they're I think culturally, Sasha, I mean, tell me if my observation is right or what's what you saw. There's almost this deference that somehow it's just innately going to do the right thing. And so all of these questions kind of always bubble back up to the court, and this body of people make these decisions. And for the most part, it's complied with. But there's a cultural reason why, and it's because the fall of the military dictatorship in the 70s was the court that brought it down. And there's kind of this heroic, I don't remember his name, but the chief of the Supreme Court's kind of like this founding father, revered as this founder, where he basically stared down the military. This moment where he's like, no, we're not doing that. We're heading in this direction. And that became the catalyst to the overthrow of the military regime. So yeah, it's a dangerous way to practice democracy by using anti-democratic efforts and leaving basically all of these major questions in the hands of a majority of this body, because it acts essentially like a Supreme Court plus.
Limiting principle.
No, and it's sort of constitutionally unclear whether it's overreached.
And they would be the arbiters of it anyway.
They would be the arbiters of that? Oh, shit.
No, and I think Mike's right. I think it's even broader. It's just how much the experience of dictatorship and the celebration of the return to democratic institutions in the mid-80s hangs over the current experience of Brazilian democracy. And so, I think folks like you have been trying to raise the alarm in our politics about what autocracy and despotism would look like if it came to the US, and what that would mean, and why it's important to forestall it. You don't have to go back a lot more than a generation to have people in Brazil who have direct experience of that and celebrate that is a kind of crucial moment in Brazil's turn towards modernity. And so institutions I think the effort to fight disinformation was supported by, very overtly, by a far broader coalition including a lot of like big business and corporate interests in Brazil that have not gotten involved in American politics in the same way in the last 4 or 5 years. Other than like the 3 hours after January 6th, where they put out statements saying that they cared about this.
And then turned the money spigot right back on a month or two later, something like that.
Because there is such cultural resonance to these questions. The other thing that's really interesting in Brazil is that Brazil is the first country on earth to use electronic voting machines. Starting in the late 90s, they developed these primitive electronic voting boxes. And starting in 2000, began using them like in a widespread way. And it is such a tremendous source of national pride for Brazil that in a part of the world that has, you know, frequently had some circus-like elections, that since toppling the dictatorship, they have not only had this sort of vibrant pluralistic democracy, but in a mechanical way, the way that they cast and count votes is this global model. You go to the electoral tribunal in Brazil, yeah, I sat in on hearings. They have a whole museum devoted to like vote casting technology that builds to this moment when they were able to get computerized machines. Mm-hmm. What did that mean? It meant a few things. It meant that like you could go into the depths of the Amazon and instead of having to carry huge bags of paper into the Amazon, which is probably not great for
paper,
like anyone.
Lots of now, reasons.
You could get to parts, remote parts of the country with this one little computer and bring it around and everybody would get to vote. You'd be able to count the results within hours on election night and have an indisputable tally. It is such a source of national pride and a core part of national identity that when Bolsonaro and his supporters started attacking the integrity of the election process, not terribly unlike the way that Trump's supporters did, it was seen as an affront to like anti-patriotic in a way that I don't think that even Trump's opponents have succeeded in messaging. And I would say, like, you know, in attacking the Brazilian electronic voting machines, it would be like, you know, attacking the NFL or Taylor Swift in the United States. But I guess we do that now too. but I do think that it has raised the kind of cultural pressure on forms of election denialism in ways that are unique to Brazilian recent history and sort of the national character.
To underscore that a little bit, I mean, their protests and rallies are very elaborate. They're kind of these beautiful displays. They're almost like parades. And then I remember like seeing all these weird costumes, people on these, you know, stilts walking through. And I'm like, what are those? And I was with somebody who was saying, they're dressed up as voting machines. Like as a source of pride, like truly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that it's wow. It's how you demonstrate your Brazilianness and the confidence in the election system is they would literally be dressed up like voting machines walking through the protests on either and or both sides.
Wow. We could use a little bit of that. Can you dress up as a Dominion machine for Halloween, Mike?
Right.
Sorry. The one of the things this chapter on Brazil brought up for me is the urge that we're seeing in a lot of people who I talk to change the rules to stop the bad guys, which is the way I think about it. The people are essentially willing to ignore their values or even democratic principles like free speech to stop the bad guys. And so I was just wondering, you know, how you see this in a way some people respond to like the wrong people on the internet, because we're now having like, there's this entire operation in the United States anyway, of trying to address the question of who gets to decide what's true, what's not, how are we going to solve this problem? And right now the status quo is we're going to label it. We're going to label information if we think it's true. And this labeling phenomenon, like putting things into boxes of misinformation or disinformation, creates the problem that someone has to then decide what falls into which of those categories, right? Whether it's a judge or someone on a trust and safety team, right? Or an engineer. And even labeling it still doesn't necessarily erase the doubts that it creates in people's minds. As a matter of fact, I'm now remembering back in 2020, it was the first ad we launched, Morning in America. Mike, do you remember when we put it on Facebook? Immediately, Facebook slapped it with a, you couldn't play the video on Facebook. And it was right after Trump had responded to it and it was going viral. And then immediately Facebook slaps it with a, this contains false information on it. And we had to fight Facebook for I don't know how many days, weeks, in order to get them to allow people to play this ad. Which, and it didn't contain false information. It was a stupid quibble over the line Main Street, bailouts for Wall Street, not Main Street. And they said that wasn't technically true. So I worry about this a lot, because I saw it up close. And, you know, one of the things we've talked on the show about in the past with Claire Wardle, who has been intimately involved with this topic, is citizen juries. So whatever platform, you know, would have 10 or 20, however many people evaluate whatever, whether something was in or out of bounds on the platform. And so I wonder what you think an American version, this sounded to me like an American version of how we might be able to adjudicate what gets slapped with a label versus what's not, as opposed to entrusting, you know, this decision to people who maybe weren't ever even trained or never thought about this question before. You have engineers who are having to decide what counts as misinformation or disinformation, and inevitably, as we have seen with lots of controversy around Twitter, I'll just put it that way, that oftentimes, yes, these are teams of people who are doing their best, but they are inevitably bringing their biases to these questions. So what do you think about the idea of citizen juries, and or have you heard of any other ways of potentially adjudicating misinformation or disinformation on platforms in the U.S.?
I've heard vaguely about the idea of citizen juries. I think one of the difficulties is just the speed here, right? And so one of the things that is effective about having one Brazilian judge who can, with his signature, order something taken down and have tech companies that are responsive to that, because they could be fined significant amounts of money and potentially lose their ability to do business in Brazil as a consequence, is stuff can happen within the hour. You know, I think one of the huge challenges of dealing with digital misinformation is that if, like, you wait till tomorrow to sort out what you're doing on something, it is potentially, you know, reached a lot of people already. And I can imagine a situation where it's just hard to build a system that is slightly more democratic and responsive, that deals on the time frame that's necessary to be effective. But all that said, like, you know, yes, the tech companies have done a pretty terrible job of both managing this problem and explaining how and why they manage it the way they do. That said, I don't envy them the challenge of content moderation. You know, some of them have, you know, I think the most disappointing thing is the companies that have claimed to have a concern or interest in content moderation and then have been inconsistent about their application or start pulling back from it in discrete ways and don't actually take it seriously, you know, which is, you know, obviously there's a lot of talk in the United States about repeal of Section 230, which is what basically insulates tech companies from being treated as publishers in civil court. I suspect that would lead to a lot of unintended consequences, but it would, all the litigation that would ensue would at least begin to force social media platforms to take responsibility for what's on their platform and come up with some set of publicly accountable procedures for how they make these decisions that can stand up to, you know, demonstrate that they are, you know, meeting some legal standard for trying to sort of responsibly take care of what's being published under their auspices. that feels important. But, you know, I think one real source of concern I would have is, I think our mind goes immediately to examples from presidential campaigns for a whole bunch of reasons. And, you know, there are reasons to think that, let's say, Facebook this year will have, you know, had their engineers and their fact-checking partners and their content moderators think about what happens if people say that Joe Biden, you know, abducted a unicorn or something. Like, okay, we've trained our algorithms to spot that. We know what we're going to do. We have our list of all the things. Are we confident that they have thought through that for every Senate race, for every county executive race, for every city council race? That they have even trained algorithms with the names of every county in the United States, let alone every candidate for every office? You know, one of the reasons that, you know, in Brazil, this happens with legal force. In the US, when presumably the thing that got your content blocked in 2020, a takedown request was submitted to the platforms, and somebody at the RNC or Trump's campaign or whatever got a Facebook person on the phone and said, hey, like,
it was PolitiFact in our case.
Somebody elevated it maybe for them to pay attention to it. And the problem is that, like, yes, the big political actors in the United States have reached to the people who are making decisions and can overrule or expedite decisions within these organizations. If you're running for county commissioner somewhere, you do not know how to get a Facebook, you know, politics ad sales lead on the phone within the hour to get something looked at. And so it is likely to linger on for days while you try to follow whatever their stated procedures are. And I suspect that if there's a worst case scenario this year, it will not be that some piece of content derails Joe Biden's campaign or, you know, a campaign for Senate, but the campaign of somebody we've never heard of in a race where voters know, as opposed to with Biden and Trump, very little about the candidates, where there might not be partisan differentiators, where one piece of misleading content could actually be really persuasive, and that the tech companies are, you know, even less equipped to deal with something like that.
I will just note for people that the Daily Caller was, in fact, in 2020, one of Facebook's fact-checking partners. So take that for what it's worth. Okay, I know we're nearing the close here, but you didn't talk about AI super very much in the book. You did mention deepfakes a couple of times, but I wonder if since finishing, you've thought any more about sort of the role, especially recently, the role AI is going to play this election and how campaigns are going to be using it. I do know from some Democratic grassroots fundraisers, people who write those emails, that they're already using AI, not this firm in particular, but other Democratic fundraising consultants are using AI to write email marketing campaigns and to automate those because they can be trained so well to sound so unhinged and optimized for conversions, dollars per click. So, how else are you hearing that campaigns are going to start using AI, if at all, and what impact do you think it's going to have?
Yeah, so I think there are a lot of tasks like writing the first draft of a fundraising email that could easily be automated, just like you're seeing in every workplace in America, some tasks that will be automated by AI. And, you know, I think a lot of campaign professionals will be happy to have a little help in that respect. Obviously, we hear sort of, you know, a lot of fear about generative AI being used for audio, video, deepfakes, fake photos. We've had examples of that on primary day in New Hampshire. There was a robocall that used a fake Joe Biden voice that I think was telling people not to vote on election day, but I still don't really understand what it was doing. And there was something recently, a picture of Donald Trump surrounded by African Americans, like just hanging out, that was fake. So I think we will see that stuff get created and circulated, some by, you know, campaigns and parties, and a lot by randos, and some of it'll kind of like gain traction, some of it won't. I would remind people before, like, we panic too deeply that this marks like some major qualitative shift in the disinformation threat, that the most pernicious lies in our politics over the last few years were not ones that required artificial intelligence or even had pictures or video attached to them. They were somebody saying something into a microphone on camera, somebody typing out a sentence in a Twitter composed box. You know, QAnon was like the textiest old school bulletin board thing, and managed to radicalize a significant portion of the American citizenry. The election denial was politicians making claims on camera about things that were false. Vaccine hesitancy has been, skepticism has been driven by, not by people like creating high tech, fake randomized control trials, but by people just, you know, spreading lies and then creating these kind of conspiracy theories around them. And so, I don't think we need high tech generative AI to lead people to sort of, you know, either believe lies or more dangerously sort of fall into these totalizing conspiracy theories.
The book is The Lie Detectives. When's it release formally?
Tuesday, March 12th, tomorrow.
Tuesday, March 12th, tomorrow. Okay. Amazing. Sasha, I got to say, I've talked to a lot of journalists, and it is a distinct pleasure to talk to somebody who knows the landscape and the tools and the players and the systems and the strategies and the tactics as well as you do. It's really, really fun, I have to say that. So you're welcome back anytime. We'd love to have you. Maybe on a roundup or something. But in the meantime, I recommend everybody go out, get The Lie Detectives if you want like an inside look at what it's like, at least inside Democratic campaigns. it's a really fun read. Thanks for being here. Mike, do you have any other thoughts?
No, it's just great to connect with somebody on Brazil, the ground. Voting machines in Brazil. It's a big thing.
All right. We'll see you later.
Thank you, Ron. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening. If you haven't yet, we'd appreciate it if you could open up the Apple Podcasts app and give us a 5-star rating and review over there. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover the show organically. If you have questions about anything we've talked about, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. And even when we can't respond, we do read everything you send us, whether it's an episode idea, a guest recommendation, or just a simple note about how the show has impacted you. And we love hearing from you. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.